Chapter 3. Day 2 in Jail. Judy, there's something in this house, Mikovits's stepfather, as he lay dying of aggressive prostate cancer. Saturday, November 19th, 2011. At 5:45 in the morning, the tower guards pealed over the loudspeakers, "Breakfast will be served in 15 minutes." A speaker in each cell linked the prisoners to the main tower, a squawking, ever-present reminder of the institutional setting. Messages could be dispatched to all cells or to an individual one. Each prisoner quickly learned a Pavlovian response to the noise. She was supposed to be fully dressed, have her bunk made, wrap her small towel around her neck, make her booking notice visible on her arm, and be facing the far wall opposite the door, with her nose actually touching the wall. Mikovits couldn't recall what had happened in the moments before the guard jostled her out of the dreamy state where she could forget where she was for a minute. Maybe she had drifted off to sleep again. Marie was preparing for the roll call, so Mikovits hurriedly swung herself down from her bunk to do the same. The previous night, she had been issued a bar of soap slightly larger than a silver dollar, as well as a single aluminum foil packet of toothpaste. She quickly used both of them, not realizing these were the only toiletries they would provide to her for the next 5 days. Not realizing the protocol, Judy faced the door as she waited, and noticed the thickness of the steel entry to their cell, and the small window, no more than 8 inches long by 6 inches wide, which allowed the guard to peer in and see if they were ready. She felt a tap on her shoulder and turned to see her cellmate motioning her to the back wall. "You need to do this," Marie said, turning to face the wall with her nose touching. "Trouble for all day if you do not do this." She exaggerated her face and gestures. The guards came by, eyeballing her booking number and attire. She passed muster, and she and Marie were perfunctorily led out of their cell and lined up against the wall until the guards were finished checking everybody. When all of the prisoners were assembled, they were marched to breakfast. Mikovits took a moment to observe the strategic layout of the facility. Each cell block was like a triangular-shaped petal attached to a center, with the cells at the far wide end narrowing down to a single exit, which led into a large circular room that was the center of the flower of these cell block petals around it. The circle served as their free time room, as well as where they got their meals before returning to their cells to eat. The tower was in the middle of the four petals that circled it, allowing the guards to see the individual cell blocks as well as the free time areas. The breakfast that morning was powdered eggs and either French toast or pancakes, which looked like it had come out of the freezer and had been thrown in a huge oven on a sheet tray. She took the filled plate, but did not plan to eat, especially not the eggs, which looked about as appetizing as decades-old food in a bomb shelter. She expected to be able to post bail by the end of the day and be released. As she looked at the reconstituted eggs on the sad-looking paper plate, all she could think of was how happy she was that her last meal before incarceration had been a wonderful breakfast burrito at Mrs. Olson's coffee hut. Mrs. Olson's was renowned for burritos so big you could slowly excavate them for a week, or she had joked, with fresh ingredients and home-style flair, heavenly by comparison. When the prisoners were done masticating the monotonous food, they pushed their trays out the door as directed. Other prisoners on their free time would come by to collect the trays and dump the paper plates in the trash. At around 11 in the morning, the speaker squawked, "Mikovits, you have a visitor. Prepare yourself." Mikovits started to head toward the back wall in order to put her nose against it when her cellmate stopped her. "No, you stand at door, hands behind your back," Marie said, modeling the proper posture. And you walk to visiting area same way, hands behind back, no handcuffs. Oh, okay. Mikovits assumed the position and looked to her cellmate for confirmation. Okay, Marie said with a validating nod. The female guard opened the door, did a cursory check of Mikovits, and, gesturing for Judy to walk in front of her, motioned her forward to the visiting area. As Mikovits walked in front of her, the guard pointed to the signet ring on the middle finger of Judy's right hand and snapped, "No jewelry, inmate." "It's been on there for a long time, probably longer than you've been alive," said Judy. It was her signet ring from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. One day in 1981, after hours in a cold room purifying natural products for cancer therapies, it had fallen off again, and in a fit of pique, Judy had slipped it over her middle finger, where it had remained snugly attached to that day. The guard was one of many people who claimed they had a trick for getting rings off, normally involving twisting the metal in a certain way or using a special cream or lotion. The guard left for a moment and returned with one of her magic creams. She put it on and tried to twist and yank the ring off of Mikovits's finger. Mikovits's knuckle became red and inflamed as the ring tightened like gag Chinese finger handcuffs. "It has to come off," said the guard after several minutes of trying. "This is for your own protection. No telling what a prisoner might do to try and get it." Mikovits understood the threat of harm coming to prisoners wearing jewelry, but there was no getting that ring off her finger. For Judy, it was a small triumph, a way to retain her own identity as an honest scientist with hard-working roots. Finally, the guard capitulated and led her in haste to the visitor's area. As Mikovits walked down the cell block in front of the guard, she could see a few other prisoners getting ready. Visiting times were Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., with cell blocks available for rotating in two-hour blocks and a half-hour between each block. The routine enforced both compliance and a sense of drudgery. Family members wanting to visit a loved one were advised to call before showing up at the facility, due to the fact that prisoners were often reassigned to different cell blocks with different visiting hours. Inmates were allowed two scant half-hour visits per week, and at each visit were limited to having two adults or one adult and one minor child. Any person entering the facility to visit a prisoner was subject to a search. The rigidity of the visiting area shocked Mikovits. It seemed as obdurate as some of the prisoners. The walls were obsidian black stainless steel, and in the visiting booths there was a single chair with a phone on the wall next to it. Mikovits went to the booth where David was waiting. She tried to give him a brave smile as she lifted the phone. "I'm doing okay," she quickly mouthed into the receiver. There was no audible reply from the other end, although she could see David's lips earnestly moving. Mikovits turned to one of the guards. "The phone isn't working," she complained. "Read the directions," the guard replied in a surly voice. Mikovits leaned close, but found that without her reading glasses, it was impossible. Like a lot of people gradually losing eyesight, she made do by picking up drugstore reading glasses. Her prescription was plus 3.25, and she knew that soon she'd need something stronger from an optometrist. All those years of peering through microscopes had taken their toll. "I can't read it," said Mikovits. The guard exhaled in frustration, as if he heard illiteracy complaints several times a day. "If you can't read, then your cellmate should be able to read the directions for you and tell you what to do." "No, I can read, it's just that I don't have my glasses." "You just pick up the phone, Dial in the 4-digit number they gave you when you came in here, followed by your booking number, and the call will go through. What 4-digit number? Mikovits asked. The one you got when you came in here. Mikovits remembered the small stack of papers she'd been given when she was processed at 2 o'clock the previous morning. It must have been in there. I think I left it back in my cell. Then I guess you'll just have to have your visit tomorrow. The moment was too much for Mikovits to endure. She started to cry. How could she be in such close proximity to David, be able to see him, and yet not be able to talk to her husband and comfort him? He looked haggard, his face ashen. The situation was obviously taking its toll. She knew he was probably worried sick that she'd been abused in jail, but that was the least of her woes. She also wanted to find out how he was faring through the shock and stress. He might not even know that she wasn't going to be carted off in the early morning hours to Reno, that she was safe for now in Ventura. This was an upright, law-abiding man, and now he had a wife in jail. What had she done wrong? Nothing. She had tried to help the patients and protect the government's money. The guard motioned for her to stand and put her hands behind her for the walk back to her cell. David looked befuddled and helpless behind the glass. She walked out of the visiting area, down the cell block, into her cell, and heard the steel door cut through the air behind her, sounding menacing and final in the way that only steel can. David was determined he wasn't going to leave the jail without talking to his wife. After Mikovits had been taken from the visiting area, David went to talk to one of the guards. He explained in his disarming manner that she didn't have her reading glasses and was unfamiliar with the jail procedures. Couldn't they bring her back one more time so she could actually speak to him? Meanwhile, Marie watched Mikovits come in and saw the distraught look on her face. When asked, Mikovits told her cellmate what had happened. "You cannot see?" Marie asked. "Maybe if the numbers were big enough." Marie looked through Mikovits's papers, found the 4-digit number and her booking number from her wristband, and wrote them on a piece of paper large enough for Mikovits to read. "Can you read that now?" Yes, I can," said Mikovits. She thought that tomorrow she would get it right. A few minutes later, though, the guard in the tower made an announcement over the loudspeaker. "Mikovits, you have a visitor." "Okay, let's try it again," said the guard when he arrived. Mikovits put her hands behind her back, the guard entered, and they made the walk down the cell block again. When she entered the room again and saw David, she felt triumphant. She sat down, picked up the phone, held the paper to her face, and dialed the numbers. The phone rang on David's side of the glass, and he picked up. "How are you?" he asked gently. "I'm fine, honey. I can handle this. I've done nothing wrong." She really was resolute and at peace. She had been shocked by the arrest, but felt the real danger was in going back to Nevada. She worried that if she was under Harvey's almost despotic control over his lackeys in the Silver State, there was no telling what might happen. He had extended his far-reaching influence into California to detain her, but folks in the Golden State weren't his flunkies. They would take the orders he had padded with official-sounding legalese, but they wouldn't do his bidding. "Good. Because I'm trying to make things work out here. I got the bail, but I don't know what's going on. It's very strange. I don't understand it. I'm talking to Harvey, and Frank is helping as well. Frank is going to talk to Harvey. It's all going to be okay." They spoke hurriedly for a few more minutes, and then their time was up. 15 minutes passed in a flash after one was locked up in jail for nearly a day. When the guard came this time, Mikovits felt serene. She was back in control of a destabilizing situation. David was working on her behalf, and Frank also had her back. They were trying to reason with Harvey. They would all figure out a solution to get her out. Back in the cell, Marie was sleeping heavily. All that Mikovits could do was crawl onto her bunk and gaze at the ceiling. Since she didn't have her glasses, she couldn't read anything. She could only lie there, making her think of the ME/CFS patients who had to stay supine and reduce neurological stimulation, trapped in a liminal world of rest. At around 4 o'clock, prisoners were taken out of their cells for free time, which usually lasted about 4 hours. The circular area, which contained the view tower, also had a room with concrete floors, steel picnic tables bolted to the ground, carts with books and magazines, and a small television mounted high on the wall, about 10 feet up to protect it from the inmates. Without her glasses, she couldn't read or follow the football game that was playing on the TV. It was as if she was in a foreign land. She tried pacing around the room, hoping the movement would wear her out a little bit for better sleep, but she still wasn't clear on all the protocols and knew that she had to watch the others for cues. When the door leading from the tower opened up and a guard walked in, all of the prisoners were supposed to immediately find a seat. A few times, Mikovits found herself the only person standing, not realizing why everybody else seemed to be playing an incomprehensible game of musical chairs. Prisoners were also taken out of their cells for lunch and for dinner. Although she didn't eat any of the lunch, she figured she should try to have some dinner, even just a slab of mystery protein to keep her strength up. Dinner was a hamburger, and she took it, sliding the meat off of the bun and eating just the patty. It tasted like the cardboard end of an old oatmeal cylinder, but she had to eat something. After dinner, and with her cellmate sleeping again, Mikovits found her thoughts drifting back to the chain of events that had caused this calamity. She tried to think positively about Harvey Whittemore, but her anger bubbled to the surface. How could he do this when they had so recently been allied for the same cause? How could he treat her like family and then do this? Hadn't they learned who she was over the past 5 years? She felt the walls of the cell closing in again. Then she prayed for Harvey and Annette to come to their senses and stop this madness. Mikovits remembered her last discussion with Annette Whittemore a few months before at the Ottawa conference in September of 2011. "I'm not going to be a part of this," Mikovits had said after explaining again that the XMRV diagnostic test wasn't clinically validated, and thus they shouldn't be selling it prematurely. Mikovits told Annette that as the principal investigator on their grants, she was more than willing to take responsibility for the previous mistakes. "But that's in the past. I won't take responsibility for failure to take direction," she continued. "We need to do the right thing. Stop everything until we figure this out." Those were the last words she said in person to Annette. Mikovits realized her words and tone to Annette had been harsh, but she knew they were honest. If she could go back and soften them, she probably would have done so, but her underlying message would remain unchanged. They could not, in good conscience, sell that ineffective test. And the question that remained unanswered, which the scientific community had little interest in investigating, was why all these people were sick with diseases like cancer, ME/CFS, and autism. To Mikovits, the path was a straight line. A scientist should investigate human disease, try to unlock its secrets, and when she does, figure out the quickest course to bring relief to those afflicted. All other issues were of secondary concern. The important question was how to deal with those who were sick now. Anything which kept patients with ME/CFS a single day longer in their darkened rooms, which kept children with autism from being able to speak the thoughts that flashed through their overexcited brains, or that put an honest scientist in jail, could only go by a simple name: evil.